Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased here to have back on the show David Sineau. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business, and for some time now he's been stopping by on a Friday to talk about personal finance and money management. He begins by making a few comments here. Sometimes talks a little bit about the economy. Sometimes it's something that's specific that has to do with financial planning. And then if you have questions about whatever it is he's about to talk about or anything else that has to do with money management, I know he will do his best to be out with your specific situation. So with that, we say good to see you. Welcome back.
Well, good morning, David, and as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. I hope everyone can put up with me a bit today because I have a little bit of a cold, so if you hear some coughing, sneezing, etc., I promise I won't give any of the listening audience that cold directly. But David, you're in pretty close proximity here, so I'm not certain I can make that promise to you. Well, in any event, I'd like to spend just a few minutes visiting with you about the stock market. Of course, it's certainly no secret that stocks continue their inexorable climb upward, despite a slumping U.S. housing market, despite weakening corporate earnings, and despite $90 a barrel of oil just last night. In fact, many of the major stock indices, both in the United States and abroad, perhaps with the exception of the volatility today, for the first time this year are either approaching their all-time highs or have even surpassed previous records. For example, the S&P 500 index through last night's close, as well as the Dow Jones Industrials through last night's close, both are within about 1% of their all-time highs. And these results really pale in comparison to some of the international emerging markets, for example. The China 600, can you imagine this number up 183% year-to-date? Hong Kong up 47% year-to-date. India up 35% year-to-date. South Korea up 38% year-to-date. And the list indeed goes on. It now appears that for the fourth consecutive year, stocks may well enjoy positive returns. Of course, the inevitable and rather obvious question arises, is now a good time to invest in the stock market? Or should we be selling stocks and preserving some of those handsome gains that we may have realized over the last 3 to 3.5 years? I'll be honest with you, that's a very, very tough question. But the answer begins by mathematically looking at our own portfolios, our own assets, and really the allocation of those assets. In other words, what percent of our assets are currently invested in stocks? What percent are currently invested in fixed income, hard assets such as gold, and perhaps real estate, whether it's residential, commercial, farmland, etc.? Clearly, all of us need liquidity. There's no question about it. And that becomes especially important in retirement. Hence, fixed income or money markets, savings accounts, certificates of deposit, all of these are vital as part of an overall portfolio. Yet most of us would like to continue to participate in the stock market. Here's my suggestion. Make certain that especially if you are no longer working, that you are in retirement, have enough in liquid securities and or income from any and all sources so that you would not be forced to sell stocks for any consecutive 36-month period of time. In other words, have enough liquid securities, fixed income, CDs on hand so that if the stock market starts to head south, you can access your liquid securities to live on as opposed to selling stocks. Could stocks head south for, say, 3 straight years, perhaps 36 straight months, even in a well-diversified portfolio? The answer is clearly yes. One need look no further than the period 2000, 2001, and 2002. The key is not to be forced to sell stocks in those inevitable periods of time when stocks decrease in value. Remember, regardless of how diversified our portfolio is, we can't overcome something called market risk. That's the risk simply of being in the stock market and the stock market on those occasions heading in the wrong direction. For those individuals with a retirement portfolio of securities, a reasonable asset allocation is generally in the area of 40 to 60% stocks or 40 to 60% fixed income, depending upon your comfort level. Additionally, to the extent that you are invested in stocks, You want, of course, to be effectively diversified. So you need to get together with your planner, your financial advisor, and take a look at the mathematics of your portfolio and see what is the true volatility of your portfolio. Here are the questions that you want to ask your financial advisor. Given my current portfolio, what is the expected return of my portfolio? And secondly, what is the range of returns that I could expect, either positively or negatively in my portfolio, to at least one standard deviation, which means at least about two-thirds of the time? What's my expected return, and what would be that range of returns? Now, of course, one example of stock diversification is our current couch potato portfolio consisting of 8 stock indices. It can be found, of course, on the WILL website. Go to Focus 580, click links, and there you'll see it, couch potato portfolio. Well, how are we doing? Through yesterday's close, our portfolio is ahead 11.08% year-to-date. Now, that's including dividends year-to-date, but again, that's pretty decent. While our benchmark, what's the S&P 500 doing inclusive of dividends? The S&P is ahead 10.08% year-to-date. So we're about 100 basis points ahead of the S&P 500. Last month, we were about 150 points behind the S&P 500. So one of the reasons that the portfolio has surged ahead is because of our international exposure. 30% of our equity position is indeed internationally invested. And for anyone who has been internationally invested, they've been pretty happy this year because those types of asset classes have far outperformed U.S. stocks, and folks have got to be very happy if they're so invested. Now, in spite of the market reaching new highs, let's consider a strategy for investing in a portfolio. All right? You've got some liquid cash. You want to be more exposed to the stock market. What might be an intelligent approach? And again, I'm suggesting a well-diversified portfolio, either through an index strategy or perhaps with your financial advisor. My suggestion would be to begin investing somewhere between 25 and 30% of the money that you wish to commit to the market. So you could go today, tomorrow. I try to buy on a down day. It looks pretty nasty right now today on the stock market. I guess that's that October 19th that everybody is very concerned about because it was, what, about 18 or 20 years ago when on an October 19th, the stock market in one day dropped 22%, the major indexes. That was a pretty bloody day on Wall Street. So here we're on one of those anniversaries. Well, in any event, it doesn't seem or it doesn't appear that that's going to happen, at least at the moment. So I would not feel reticent about investing 20 to 30% of my money that I'm sitting on the sidelines. And then with the rest of the money, dollar cost averaging the remaining funds over a 12 to 18 month period of time. Now, we haven't spent a lot of time talking about dollar cost averaging. A lot of you know what it is, but dollar cost averaging in a nutshell simply means investing the same fixed sum of money each month or each period of investment into a series of investments. That's really all it is. If the market moves down, your money buys more cheaper shares of the position. If the market moves up, you end up buying fewer shares, which are more expensive. That's exactly what you want to do. You want to be in a position when money markets and move down that you can take more of your money and buy more shares. When stocks are expensive, the same amount of money is buying less shares. So in volatile times like the present, dollar cost averaging really makes a lot of sense because the real winner at the end of the day, is the individual with the most shares. When you invest in the stock market, remember, you are in the share accumulation business. You are not in the price accumulation business. There is a big time difference. And as a result, dollar cost averaging helps you accumulate shares. Well, in any event, despite today's volatility, we'll have to stay tuned to see if 2007 represents, well, a fourth consecutive year of substantial gains in the stock market. What the stock market seems to be telling us is that our economy will not fall into recession, and that the Federal Reserve will continue to move aggressively to even lower interest rates if they feel necessary to avoid, obviously, a very nasty housing market, a very nasty mortgage crisis from further spreading in the economy. So there you have it, David. I'd be delighted to answer questions about stocks, the stock market at the moment, or we could talk about any number of issues which our listeners might be interested in raising.
All right. Our guest is David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business once a month, always on a Friday. He's here. We talk about personal finance, money management. So if you have questions, just pick up the telephone and give us a call. 333-9455. That's the number for here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you can give us a call. We've got some folks here lined up. Joe, where do things stand now with the concerns about the collapse of the banking industry generally and people who do mortgages specifically related to the low-end lending crisis?
Well, where the banking industry is really being hurt is not in the conventional area. Even though conventional mortgages are somewhat higher in default, we're really talking about subprime mortgages, and what we're really talking about is banks who have been in the business of putting portfolios of subprime mortgages together. And from all indications, that represents about a $200 to $300 billion debacle at the moment. And what banks have obviously been doing is they have been getting together, as you've been reading about, and setting up huge pools of liquidity so that they can hold on to these mortgage positions so they don't let them go at fire sale prices and further depress profits of these major money center banks. But again, the default ratio on these subprime mortgages continues to escalate. We're looking at somewhere between 16 and 20%, depending upon who you believe, especially serious in California markets, Arizona markets, Florida markets. And not surprisingly, we seem to have the largest real estate drops in those areas. Interestingly enough, in the good old-fashioned Midwest, where things didn't go up quite like they did in other areas of the country, it's a much less pronounced crisis. But even in the real estate world, what we really do have is we have tremendous amounts of unsold inventory. Mm-hmm. Available, yeah. Whether it's houses that are currently for sale that are previously built houses or new construction. And you also see our major home builders across the country writing down their construction areas, writing down their land values, and even going to auctions to sell properties. What's really egregious, what's really unfortunate are the people who stepped in, and I saw this, what was it, on 60 Minutes last week, where you've got a homeowner who stepped into one of the areas around Las Vegas, Nevada, spent $650,000 for the home. It was the home of their dreams. It was in a new construction area with a builder. The builder is now offering the identical house at auction at $395,000. Can you imagine paying $625,000, going out and probably buying and getting an 80, 90% mortgage and finding out that you're upside down. Yeah. Not just a little bit upside down, but way upside down. Yeah, that's okay. A huge crisis.
Well, we have a couple callers here ready to go. Let's talk with them. First, someone in Bartlett. That's the first caller on the toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hey, good morning. Hey, love it. This is great. I'm kind of confused with the stock market, though, because I've seen companies come out and post earnings and other things, and it's good, it's up, everything's got up, but then their stock goes down. And I've been seeing that in a few of the technologies lately. I don't know what's up like with that. But the other thing is, too, I'm a product of that housing trend, I want to say call it recycle, but I'm a contractor slash home builder who's basically out of business now. There's work out there, but very, very little, and I can't afford to put my family at risk anymore, and I'm not the only one. So I'm surprised the stock market isn't here in the housing. People don't understand. There's a lot of people out of work now. I mean, there's thousands and thousands of people out of work. There's thousands of people out there that have lost mortgages and whatnot. I mean, with the cost of the gas, everything has gone up. I mean, everything costs double what it did last year for you to survive. And I'm kind of disappointed in one way with the way the stock market's reacting to it. I think I basically, my opinion, I think we're in a recession.
Well, I hear you strongly, and I do hear and feel your pain. And some of the points you've made, especially about unemployment, new claims for unemployment were up dramatically this week, reflecting tremendous numbers of people like yourself who've been displaced in various industries, including the housing industry. I read this morning, for example, that 2,000 jobs were going to be displaced in Chicago with Amoco BP. Can you imagine that? And they're in the oil industry. So what the stock market, remember, when the stock market is moving ahead, what they're telling us is that things are going to get better 6 to 9 months down the road. The stock market is a predictor of the future. So we can't look at it as just what's happening today. If we did that, you're absolutely right. And that's one of the reasons that we see so much volatility in the stock market. So we see companies, you're absolutely right, where we have companies that are posting higher earnings, and yet the next day that their stocks are trading narrower or lower. But again, in terms of the overall trend of the stock market, what they're suggesting is, yes, we've got these crises. Yes, they are serious, but they're going to be overcome. And the stock market is looking 9 to 12 months down the road. Tell me something, if you're still on the air. Are you still on the air?
The caller hung up.
Caller hung up. I was interested to hear about a little bit more about construction and contracting.
Well, there you got to wonder. I think a lot of people said, for example, when you're talking about housing values, that they were overblown for a long time, and that maybe a correction was due, and maybe that's what this is. And though we might expect things to bounce back, I don't think we're ever going to see the point where we were, well, I don't know, maybe just 2 years ago.
Well, that remains to be seen. It's not going to bounce back apparently very quickly, because it's going to take a long time to eat up this inventory of homes that are either on the market for resale or new construction. What's surprising is still the amount of construction that is being put up in the country in spite of this. So, yes, it's going to take some time to work our way out of it. And that's why the Fed, it seems to me, is going to be forced to continue to lower interest rates. And one of the difficulties that that puts the Federal Reserve in is that ultimately when you lower interest rates – and you have all of that inflation building up, it's going to make the inflation issue much worse down the road. That's why gold is at all-time highs, for example. That's why oil is very high. It's betting that we're going to see more inflation down the road. So Bernanke's really got a tough situation on his hands.
All right. The caller actually is back with us, the caller we had before. I don't know. Maybe he was interested in responding to your question about, you know, what was going on with the
Well, sir, you were in the construction business.
Right. Well, I'm getting out of it, and I'll tell you, here's what happens. If you're building a house, you've got framers, you've got contract concrete guys, you've got a group of, you know,
subs.
20, 30, 40 people, right? Well, it's kind of hard to line up all these people in the spur of the moment. You know, so basically when I've got 50 people hanging around, I have to find work for them. Unfortunately, there's just nothing out there. So I have to let them go. You know, and here's what's going to happen is the boom will start again, but then I have to look for qualified guys again, which means more time out of my, you know, try and find people that I could put together to do stuff. Now, I have downsized myself. I'm basically getting out of building houses and have been going into the remodeling business, and I've kind of done that in the last couple of years. And I've been in this business for 25, almost 30 years, and I've never seen it ever. I started my own business up about 14 years ago, but I've been doing it since 1985.
Okay.
And I got to tell you, I personally don't trust the stock market. I have stock in a major corporation, and I even the corporation I have it in is kind of fluctuating. It's strange too. I mean, when they come out with reports of quarterly earnings and the stock goes down, the cost of living in general kind of shot me down right there.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
like almost half my pay by the time at the end of the month, all
sure.
the expenses I put out. Just to live, it's half my pay. So, I mean, you know, I'm really frustrated the stock market doesn't come out. At least Bernanke comes out and says, let's drop it another quarter of a point or something. Because he's going to end up doing it anyway. You know, sooner I think would be better than later, because this is typically coming October, November, December, and in January is kind of the slow months.
Slow months anyway, aren't they? And so you're going to have more unemployment unless we have some Christmas rush. So, again, thanks for your input. I really appreciate it.
Don't be surprised that this winter that the outlook for Christmas spending is way down.
Yeah.
Because nobody's got the money.
I'd agree with you. They don't feel very wealthy when the value of their equity in their homes has been plummeting.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go talk with somebody here on a cell phone. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi, is this me?
Yes.
Hi. I'm going to ask my question, and then I'm going to just listen on the air. I'll hang up.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you about the health or lack thereof of the American dollar. I've been advised recently by somebody close to me that I should think about getting some of my investments out of American dollars and into foreign currency or into something like gold. And I wondered what you thought about that. And I'll listen on the air.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, there's no question that the American dollar continues to plummet and set new record lows against the euro. And can you imagine when I used to go fishing in Canada, David, that the American dollar was worth at least 30-35% more than the Canadian loonie?
Mm-hmm.
And now things have really gotten loony because obviously the Canadian loonie is worth more than the American dollar.
I was there on vacation and managed to be there for the point where the Canadian dollar hit its highest point in the last 30 years.
Was there cheering in the streets?
Well, when you read the Canadian press about mm-hmm. it, actually, mm-hmm. it seemed like there was a very mixed sort of reaction that, for example, that Canadians who live along the border and could hop in their car and drive over the United States and shop, well, for them, maybe that's a good thing. But, for example, the Canadian forest products industry, mm-hmm. the people mm-hmm. who make the lumber that this guy we talked to from Bartlett, you know, would be using to build houses, they were really unhappy about it. And on the other hand, Canadian industry, if you buy raw materials from the United States, well, that's a good thing.
Sure.
So it sort of depends,
depends on where you are in the
tourism. It depends on where you are, exactly.
No question.
I was not real happy about it, but what are you going to do?
Well, look, a couple of things are happening. One is that Bernanke is being put in a position where he's going to be lowering interest rates, right? And that, of course, means that if you're holding dollars, treasuries, you're going to get less of a return. We still have substantial inflation. We have countries around the world and currency traders who feel that our national debt is going to continue to explode, that as a country we are not savers, that we're continuing to increase our national debt, no question about it. And none of this gives a great deal of confidence in the American dollar. So there are good reasons to believe that this is just going to continue. I don't see it changing at the moment. So what do we do about it? Well, one thing we can do about it is we can invest internationally. And one of the reasons that international stocks, for example, have done so well is that they have had a very substantial return just in terms of the currency relationship between the U.S. dollar and the euro. So that is one choice of being in international stocks. Another, of course, is being in hard assets. But again, that's very, very tough when these hard assets are at all-time highs. Very, very tough. And I certainly would be very concerned about putting more than 5% of my portfolio into hard assets, be it gold, silver, commodities, etc. I think about a 5% asset allocation is about all that I could stomach personally. Perhaps others feel differently, but that would be my position on that particular matter. The other reason, I think, if you look at Canada and why Canada is doing so well against the United States, at least in terms of currency, take a look at the deficit and the budget of Canada on a unitary basis. What we find out is that Canada really doesn't have national debt. Okay? We have a lot of national debt in the United States. So, again, investing in a country like Canada, that makes sense to me in order to protect the currency risk of U.S. currency.
We're midway through this part of Focus 580. Have other calls we'll get right to. I'd just like to introduce again the guest, David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I and the College of Business. Once a month on a Friday, he's here and talks about personal finance and money management. If you have a question, give us a call, and he will do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Urbana is next, line 3. Hello.
Yes. Hello, David.
Hi, good morning.
I have a related question, one related to the last one, in regard to international stocks. They, of course, are much more expensive than American stocks because of the way the dollar has fallen, vis-a-vis the euro particularly. So you're paying much more up front for these international stocks. What would be the strategy in terms of buying them? Would you get into them? Would you take either from your U.S. portfolio and move stocks into international, or would you take cash and put in? Would you do it immediately? Would you cost average on that? I mean, the prediction is that the dollar is going to fall even further than it is now. How would you invest in international stock now when they're so expensive?
Well, first of all, I would look at my asset allocation, and I think it is reasonable to have 30% of my stock portfolio diversified internationally. Okay? That's my bogey. So if you don't have 30%, you want to figure out how to get up to that number. A number of money managers who I've talked to say, Dave, that's too conservative. You should be 50-50. That's a little bit difficult for my just good old-fashioned upbringing at the moment. I just haven't come over and subscribed to that kind of thinking. But 30% is a reasonable number. All right. So let's assume, for example, that you're 10% international and you want to move up to 30% international. That would entail either selling current U.S. stock positions and probably taking some profits and reallocating them internationally. Now, do you do that all at once? I would do the 50-50 rule. And that is that I would say, all right, whatever I'm going to reallocate, I'm going to reallocate 50% now, and then I'm going to dollar cost average over the next 12 to 18 months with the other 50% of the money that I'm going to allocate into international positions. And also, these emerging markets have really been on fire. As you know, the last 3 years we're looking at unbelievable returns. 40-45% returns have been pretty much the standard. And, you know, things do eventually regress back to the mean. And while there is still a tremendous amount of bullishness on emerging markets, and a lot of that reason has to do with the emerging markets are very, very solid and very, very strong in technology and high tech. And that really has led this rush into these particular areas. I'm pretty leery of the Chinese stock market at the moment. So in terms of just allocating directly into a China mutual fund, I'm not very excited about that. And even if it goes up a great deal more, I'm still just thinking that that has to have a substantial setback. So I'd be looking for a more diversified emerging markets fund, perhaps something like the Vanguard Emerging Markets Fund, to dollar cost average into a percentage there. The total international index, again, a number of mutual fund companies have wide exposure to Europe, Australia, the Far East, et cetera. So I'd be looking at mutual funds. I'd be taking half of my money that I'm going to allocate now and then dollar cost averaging the remaining 50% over 12 to 18 months.
What about something like a Fidelity Diversified International, which is largely European?
Yeah, that's okay to take care of your European exposure. You still need Far Eastern exposure and emerging markets exposure. That particular fund is more like a great big, those are great big companies. So you want to look for something as well as smaller companies internationally.
Would you do that with cash, or would you, if you had some cash in reserve, or would you do that with, by moving stocks?
Well, I think I would still keep some powder on the sidelines, and to the extent that I'm not currently allocated in my stock positions with at least 30% internationally, I'd probably be more likely to take some profits in my U.S. positions and sell a little bit of that down. And again, you can dollar cost average out of that. It's not necessary to sell all at once. One can dollar cost average out of selling a position just as dollar cost averaging into buying a position.
Thank you very much.
Right, my pleasure.
You. Let's go next to someone in Danville. This is line one. Hello.
Hello. I have a stock in an entity that I've held since 1982. And I recently received a letter from that company that they were considering dividing into two entities, and one of them is to continue much of the financial business that we're accustomed to, and propose to continue the same dividend rate. The second company, I don't know even what that is supposed to mean, but my initial investment was $1,300 and $20 a share, and because of splits in the company, that original share basis is $1.11. But I have continued always reinvested the dividends over these last 25 years, and so accumulated a good bit more. My question is, when this split occurs, how do I calculate my new basis? On this split, you get 3 shares to continue with for every 3 shares you own of the original company. And then this other split off is 1 share for every 3 that you have originally. And they propose that this new company will not pay any dividends for a while. So do I divide it by 4 and...
Well, let's think about this. For every share that you currently have, you're going to get 3 more shares of one company.
Yes.
And for every share that you have, you're also going to get 3 shares of the other company?
No. For every 3 shares, I will get 3 shares of the original company.
All right.
We'll continue to pay the dividends.
So you're getting 4 new shares altogether.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Right. For every 3 shares, then I get 1 for this new entity, which proposes no dividends.
Well, typically, you should receive in the prospectus how that should be allocated. But basically, you could, in terms of simple math, it seems to me that you could divide your current basis by 4, and that would give you your new basis in all of the shares.
Well, I have been keeping my basis in the original shares separate from the basis of the shares that I've accumulated by dividend reinvestment. Just because, well, I have those in certificate form, and it would just be easier.
Okay. Do you have an accountant?
I'm my accountant.
You're the accountant.
Right.
All right. All right. Well, I'd have to mathematically figure it for you off the air. You're welcome to call me off the air, and I could figure it out for you if you like. How would that be?
Well, I can divide.
All right. Well, I'm just saying that if you're getting 4 new shares that you could divide, and then that probably would give you pretty close to your new basis.
Okay, but still continue to assign the basis separate.
Yes.
From, okay.
Yes.
All right, then, thank you.
Okay, right, my pleasure.
To Champaign County, this is the next caller, line number 2. Hello.
Hello. I have a question that is related to going back to the mortgage situation. I'm a graduate student right now, and during graduate school, I've accumulated some credit card debt because I used to work a lot of overtime, and now I'm not able to do that because of school. And I'm wondering, with the mortgage situation being what it is, if now is a good time, I guess either a better time or a worse time to think about rolling credit card debt into my home mortgage.
Do you have a 30-year mortgage or a 15?
I have a 30-year mortgage.
Okay. I'm just looking at current rates with 30-year mortgages, and I haven't checked them locally in Champaign. Nationally, they're about between 6 and 6.25%, which is a very competitive rate. And what you can look at is the 10-year Treasury. And the 10-year Treasury, is about 4.6. It's been trading in the 4.5 to 4.6 range. And you add about 1.75% to that. And that would give you an idea of what a 30-year mortgage would cost.
Okay.
So it's okay to refinance and roll credit card debt into your mortgage, so long as you're not going to get right back on the old path of indebting yourself on those credit cards again.
Gotcha.
That's the real issue.
I'm closing in on the end of my graduate degree here, and I don't know for certain that I'm going to stay at the same company, but for instance, if I were to stay at the company that I'm working at now, the advanced degree would not quite double, but it would... Maybe I would go from mid-30s to mid-50s.
That'd be great. That'd be great. Let me ask you another question. Are you in a 401k plan or a profit-sharing plan with your company?
No.
Are you eligible to participate?
Yes, I am.
But you've chosen not to participate.
Well, with the lower pay that I'm getting right now because of not being able to work overtime. Historically, I've always worked 10 hours of overtime, so with having lost that additional income, I opted not to be in the 401k because that percentage I'm using for living expenses.
Okay.
Not to go into further debt.
Yeah, understood. Understood. What I was going to suggest is if you did have a 401k, you could look at the potential of borrowing. And
okay.
I don't usually recommend it, but if you have a steady job and you're paying yourself back that interest rate, that's cheaper than doing it through a credit card debt.
Okay. But if I don't, I was in the 401k for a couple of years, but I don't have, I'm sure I don't have the amount in there that I would need to borrow.
Right. The rule basically says that you can borrow out 50% of your vested balance or $50,000, whichever is less.
Okay.
And if you borrowed it out, you would have to repay it over 60 months, typically at about prime interest rate, which is probably cheaper than your credit cards. Plus, you're repaying yourself at that prime interest rate.
I see.
Understood?
I see. So it's additional savings in the end.
Yes.
Okay.
But
with the mortgage situation being what it is, it hasn't made it a worse idea.
No, not at all. Not at all. In fact, interestingly enough, mortgage rates are still highly competitive.
Okay. Very good. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Well, we're talking this morning here with David Sinnoh. He is here every month on the program. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business, and he stops by. We talk about personal finance issues, and if we can help you out with some advice, you give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
Well, David, I saw this week that it sounds like the first of the baby boomers, 77 million of us, are marching towards Social Security benefits. And in fact, I think there was a big brouhaha this week on national television of the first woman who actually signed up for those Social Security benefits. She was labeled the first of the 77 million baby boomers coming down the road on Social Security. Now, in one sense, that's great for the people who are retiring and going to access Social Security benefits, but it just is going to exacerbate this whole issue of how in the world are we going to fund Social Security. It's a funny thing that for every beneficiary currently drawing Social Security, there's about 3.5 people working. It's about 3.5 people working. And this is an interesting statistic. I just learned this week. The average person who is drawing Social Security in the United States, that Social Security represents about 36% of the average annual compensation that they had been making while they were working. Okay, so we take that 36% number. The average individual is paying into Social Security, of course, 6.2, plus the corporation or the company that they're working for pays in 6.2. So that equates to about 12.4% of payroll for a Social Security person paying into the system. Hmm. So if we divide the 36% and we divide that about 12.4%, what that tells us is that we need about 3 people in the workforce working for every person drawing Social Security just mathematically to stay at break even. And here's the problem. 77 million working Americans, that's me, ladies and gentlemen, are marching closer each day to accessing that Social Security, which means we're going to be soon at 2.5 workers, maybe 2.25 workers for every recipient of Social Security. And obviously, we go into a negative cash flow. Now, interestingly enough, we've enjoyed positive cash flows for a number of years. We're getting real close to that break even. And that positive cash flow has actually amounted to about $2 trillion of positive cash flow. Well, where did that get eaten up? Is it sitting in some savings account, some lockbox, some trust account? No, I guess not, because we took that $2 trillion, and that's us, we're the government. We took that $2 trillion and we spent it. Okay? So that we wouldn't have a greater national debt. But somewhere in the Department of the Treasury, believe it or not, and in the Social Security Department, there is an actual box, kind of like a lockbox, and it's got a stack of U.S. Treasury IOUs that it says, yes, we are the U.S. Treasury. We owe the Old Age Workers Assistance Program, that's Social Security, we owe you $2 trillion. So what's going to happen when Social Security runs into a negative cash flow? The Social Security gentleman walks over to the Treasury gentleman or lady and says, Madam or Sir, I've got this Treasury instrument. Please redeem it so we can pay our Social Security beneficiaries because apparently we've got too many people retiring and we don't have enough worker bees out there. So we've got to cash this money in. What in the world is the Treasury going to do? Well, I guess they're going to cash this in. How are they going to do that? I think they're going to have to issue new debt. That's what's really going to happen. More IOUs, more interest having to be paid out, more inflating of the national debt. This is a huge problem marching down the road. And there aren't a lot of good solutions. One solution, we could cut back on benefits. A second solution, well, I guess what we could do is increase normal retirement age for youngsters today. For example, students in my class, why, that age is now 67. I suppose we could move it up to 68 or 69. Alternatively, we could increase the payroll tax rate from 6.2% to a higher rate. Or alternatively, at least in the year 2007, the first $97,500 of earned income is subject to that Social Security tax. We could dramatically increase that, maybe to $125,000, $150,000, or just unlimited. These are tremendously hard choices. Yeah. I don't have solutions, but it is interesting. We are now seeing that march of baby boomers actually starting to retire.
Yeah. I think there are probably some people who have looked at this who would say that chances are pretty good that we're going to do all of those things.
Imagine
that you
that.
Mentioned, and including probably some greater sorts of means testing, that is looking at the person's income, how much money they have in assets, and doing something to determine what benefit that they have, so that we're going to say that some people, you've got enough money. You really don't need this as much as somebody who has much.
And we argued about this in our Social Security lecture in my class on employed benefits just this week. So I asked the question, what's the bogey? What's the means test, David? What is it, $250,000 of income? Is it $100,000 of income, excluding Social Security? That's a tough issue.
Yeah.
And if you paid in for 35 years into the system, and you were one of the fortunate Americans to do well, to have a substantial retirement income without Social Security, are you willing to say, yep, I've been a lucky American, I've been fortunate in this society, that's right, I shouldn't receive Social Security? A very tough political football. Yeah.
Is there some possibility, can it actually, starting at some point in the future, can the government say to people, we require you to be in some kind of pension plan where you're going to put your money aside yourself? We're going to say to you, you know, you must be in a 401k or a 403b, you know, whatever it is that you're eligible through your employer to do. We're going to require you to actually participate.
Well, under the Pension Protection Act, which really is going into effect January 1 of 2008, there has been some legislation that at least suggests with 401k plans, and that seems to be the master plan now, defined benefit and pension plans, unless you work for a government agency or quasi-governmental agency, that day is really over. Mm. And companies are saying you've got to save for yourself. Under the Pension Protection Act, what that act says is, look, if you're an employee and you're in a 401k plan, your employer is going to essentially take 3% of your salary and put it into that plan for you. It's your money, but it's going into the plan. And if you don't like that, you must affirmatively opt out of the plan. So in the olden days, you affirmatively opted in to a plan. In the new day, you're going to have to affirmatively opt out of a plan. Just an enormous problem, because Social Security has been part of this three-legged stool. For many, many elderly Americans, it's 30, 40, 50% or more of that retirement stool, that one leg. The other legs might have been some kind of pension benefit that they had, but that day is almost over, and then personal savings. So it's just going to be an enormous issue. It's not going to get solved until what? We have a new presidential election. Then I guess we'll have the old-fashioned blue ribbon committee, maybe of the Republicans and the Democrats, because when you can't decide, what do? You get a blue ribbon committee together to make recommendations so everybody's unhappy.
Yeah, and then they make a big report, mm-hmm. and the president says, thank you very much mm-hmm. for this great report and for your services, and then they take the report and they put it on the shelf.
Put it on the shelf. Oh, no. Just go put on. It on the shelf. Okay. Right.
Let's talk to somebody here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Would you comment on the drug prescription bill that was recently passed that has unfunded, no funding mechanism to it. It's 5 or 6 times the funding liability of Social Security, and it seems to be one of the most financially irresponsible actions by federal government in modern times.
I think you've summed it up quite correctly, that in terms of its financial impact on the budget, it is gigantic. As a matter of fact, the Medicare issues in general make Social Security pale in comparison. We're looking at unfunded future value costs of somewhere between $10 and $12 trillion to continue to fund Medicare Part A, B, and, of course, with the drug program, Part D. And I'll be honest with you, even people who are receiving drug benefits under Part D, most of them find it awfully confusing. They find that they're subject to large deductibles. They're finding out that many of their prescriptions are really not covered. And the whole thing, to be honest about it, is a bloody mess. Now, having said that, as a wealthy society and believing in altruism, do we not have some major responsibility to take care of our elderly population who cannot afford to do that themselves? I think the answer to that is also yes. At least I feel pretty strongly about that. But again, you're absolutely right. This is a dramatic unfunded mandate, which is going to have enormous actuarial ramifications for our society.
What did you say the unfunded liability was? 10, 12
trillion? 10 to 12 trillion.
Yes,
right.
Sir.
10 to 12 trillion. That's what it's estimated to be between Medicare A, B, and D as all of us march down that road. And actuarially, we're just living a whole lot longer. That's what's really happening. I saw some statistics today of people who are born today. They have an 85 to 90% certainty of living to age 65. And 50 years ago, it was about a 35 or 40% certainty. And the numbers of people who are going to live into their 90s, 95, and 100, it's just inordinate number. And under medical care, we typically spend 50% of the total amount of money we spend in a lifetime is spent in the last year of our life. So again, another tremendous problem politically facing our country. And the sooner we deal with it, obviously, the better.
Yeah, try to get one more caller here. Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I was really glad to hear the way that your guest addressed the Social Security problem, not being young. That's pretty important to me. But what I'd hope that your listeners would recognize that it isn't just demographics that put Social Security in trouble. As your guest said, it's the borrowing from the Social Security Trust Fund. But if they look at the last 8-7 years and how billions and billions of dollars have been spent, and it certainly hasn't been for the good of the United States in any way on the war, that money paid back to the trust fund would make an enormous difference. Thank you.
All right. Well, there is no question that regardless of how one feels about how we have been spending money at the federal level, the fact remains that we have taken positive cash flows from Social Security and spent it for other sources of expense. And that is a fundamental problem. And if we had that repaid without the Treasury having to go out and borrow that, that would make an enormous impact, positive impact, on this whole Social Security issue. But unfortunately,
We're not in that situation.
All right. Well, we're going to have to stop for this time around with the promise that I think the day will be back next month, and we'll do it again.
We will, and it's been lots of fun today.
David Sinnoh, he's clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business. Once a month on a Friday, he's here. We talk about personal finance and money management. I encourage you to call, and I know Dave does his best to help you out with his advice.